Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Minority Reports. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh. We have a fantastic guest today. This guest is a hilarious comic. I've worked with him multiple times, and he has a phenomenal podcast called They Try to Bury Us. I mean, this guy's a rock star. Like, I'm amazed he even made time for me. Welcome, Tamara Catan, man. I'm such a fan of yours. You know,
thanks, Mona. I'm a fan of yours, too. Thanks for the kind words. That's really nice.
Anytime, man. Anytime. Yeah. You're in New York City. You were saying you got COVID?
Yeah, I got COVID. At the time, I was living in Brooklyn. I'm in the Lower East Side now in Manhattan.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was living in Brooklyn and taking the subway multiple times a day into the city. And then a lot of my shows were in the Village on McDougal Street. So every club was a cellar club.
Sure.
You know, in these really tight spaces where they invented the thumb as applause because they were waking up their neighbors instead of applause. That's where they invented this.
Really? I did not know that.
It was sort of like the beatniks.
Wow.
And during the Lenny Bruce times and prior and stuff, they started doing this stuff. And on top of taking the subway every day and working in cellar clubs, I work at a boxing gym part-time, and I was rapping in a famous boxing gym. So I was like wrapping the hands of people visiting from Europe and Asia and all over.
So, I mean, when did you get it? Did you get it like last November? Like, when did you get it?
Oh, no. I got it like in end of February.
Oh, wow.
End of February, beginning of March.
Which is when the government was coming out and shutting everything down.
Yeah.
So were you hospitalized for this?
No, not at all. I think it's funny. I mean, I do not blame the news for highlighting the most severe cases because that's what's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
People don't want to see they want to see what could happen to them. So I don't blame the news. But the majority of people I know that are in semi-decent shape,
yes.
Like I got it. It felt like food poisoning in the sense that something foreign was in my body for sure. And by foreign, I mean something I've never felt before. Human instinct is a real thing. Like it definitely, I felt like there was something in my body that didn't belong there in a way that you feel like food poisoning, you know? And, and it was so funny, Mona. Like I literally said to myself, oh, this really sucks that there's this COVID thing going around because now I can't tell the difference between COVID and food poisoning or just a regular sickness. And I go, well, it can't be COVID because at least I don't have the chills. And I didn't even say the S in the word chills before I started trembling.
Wow.
Yeah, so I totally got the chills that night.
That's instant manifestation, man.
Yeah, it was really weird. And you know what's funny is I immediately went into meditation because I meditate.
Yeah.
And I immediately just like told myself, hey, you live alone in a tiny apartment. This is a terrible time to go to a hospital. You can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Which, as comedians without healthcare, I think a lot of us have that feeling all the time.
Yes.
You know, so the feeling that some of these people are having during COVID, that's how artists feel all the time. And a lot of people that America chooses to not take care of. That's how we feel.
Yeah, we're like that bag, you know, that plastic bag in American Beauty. You remember that?
Yeah, of course. It's my favorite character in the movie.
Whirling through the wind, baby. That's us.
Yeah.
Plastic bag. Yeah.
Totally. And so I stayed really calm. And the next day I felt better. But still, I had some, you know, stomach upsetness. I had diarrhea, which was another symptom. Wow. And then the day after that, I felt like 50% better. Wow. And then 50% better almost each day for the next six. So it was in and out of me in 6 to 8 days.
Okay.
Only 2 days where I felt like, oh, I was a little bit lightheaded and tightness in my chest and all that.
Yeah.
And it went away. I just stayed calm and it went away. And I didn't, you know, I tried to not do anything stupid. I stopped smoking weed. I stayed away from everybody. I self-quarantined. And then 14 days later, I came to LA because my mom is in LA.
Yeah.
And I got an Airbnb, a tiny little Airbnb, and self-quarantined for another 14 days. And during that time, I went and got a test, an antibodies test at this clinic in Huntington Beach. Actually, it was in Westminster at the mall in Westminster in front of the JCPenney.
Yeah.
And 3.5 hours in line.
That's a good place for tests.
It was great. It was a great place to test.
Yeah.
It was a doctor in Huntington Beach. I read an article about him in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to go do it. And 15 minutes later is a blood test to test that it's already been in your body. which is simpler than the nose swab to prove if you actually have it now.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, and 15 minutes later, they walked out to my car and they said, hey, wow, you have it. You had it, because I had evidence of both antibodies, which meant I had it recently. Oh, when there's only one, it means it was farther away. But yeah, it was, and I was like, oh, I knew it. It wasn't even a shock to me. I was like, I knew I had it. It wasn't.
You know, I have friends living in New York City, and they were like, look, if you live in New York City, you have had it or probably have it right now. I mean,
yeah, probably.
There's no way to escape it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that's true. You know, it's interesting, though. Like, I always wondered why things were the way that they were in New York and in America at the same time when we compare ourselves to Europe. And one of the things was the subway.
Yeah.
And it's a private company. They make tons of money off of taxpayers.
Yep.
And, you know, I go, why is it so filthy all the time? I guess it's just too big. But yeah. London's super clean. Paris is clean. Spain is clean. Every other major city, Barcelona, Madrid, all incredibly clean subways. And then when they realized that people were paying attention to the filth and that filth could be actually connected with death and wrongdoing, and then every day the subway was closed from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. and they cleaned it. And they were the cleanest subways I've ever seen in my life. And I'm like, that was simple. Like, why couldn't we have done that before? I hope that they don't stop doing it now.
I mean, look, I grew up in New York City. All the subways I remember are just gross, filthy. And the summers are brutal because you smell the pee that you never smelled in during the winter. You're just like,
that's right.
So
but it doesn't have to be that way. Have to be. They just let it be that way because us citizens were like, that's acceptable. And they're like, okay, then why should we dig into our profits to make it more
precisely,
clean?
Precisely. I mean, you know, I'm glad you're better and I'm glad you got the antibody test. I had a scare where I had been home most of the time because during the pandemic, and I have a bit of a termite situation in my place. So my landlord, an orchid person to come and take a look at my place. And he must have been going from place to place. So he's exposed to a lot more things than I am. And I made the dumb mistake of not putting my mask on when he came in. And he left, and literally within an hour, sore throat, my ear
hurting.
And I was just like, I don't know what's going on. That's weird, right? And I was like, is that the symptoms?
No, it's too fast.
Yeah, it's too fast.
It's way too fast. Yeah, it's like, but it is. It shows you how powerful our minds are. I have no doubt that you really felt those things.
You know what happened, Timmer? I had 101 fever all night. And I woke up and I couldn't wake up because I had like severe 101 fever. And I was like, holy shit, what am I going to do? So I got myself in an Uber, like covered myself up, got to an urgent care, and they tested me. They're like, do you have a fever? And I'm like, I don't think I have a fever. They're like, your fever is 102 right now. You need to step out of our urgent care because all the symptoms you're showing is of COVID. So you need to step outside. I was like, what do you mean step outside? They were like, sorry, we can't help you. You have to go to a hospital. So like, I get myself to Cedars and I'm admitted from like 8:30 in the morning to like 1:30 in the afternoon. And they're like pumping me with like, you know, like IV, they're running all these tests on me, you know, my fever refused to break. It was just, fever would not go down. And they were like, we got to break the fever first. So they finally were able to break the fever. And they were like, okay, you tested negative for COVID. They're like, there's some kind of a virus, some kind of a bacteria you picked up. And what it was doing, it was closing my throat. So I couldn't talk and I couldn't
drink. That's scary.
It was terrifying. And I was like, what the hell? And I came home and I was trying to fall asleep and I felt somebody was sitting on my chest and like choking me. So I just kept waking up in like a panic. It was the most bizarre thing in the world. But you know, because COVID's going around, you're thinking, oh fuck, I think I have COVID now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a real life horror story where the monster is a virus, you know, and it's like Freddy Krueger and a war mixed together into one terrible experience. I think we all have PTSD and we're going to start realizing it as we start going back out.
I mean, speaking of Freddy Krueger, I live a block away from Ogden, which is where the house is for the night.
That's perfect.
That is a true story. And I recently learned that through a neighbor. They're like, did you know that's Nightmare on Elm Street? I'm like, you're absolutely right. This is the house of Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's so cool though. Yeah. I love LA for that, for stuff like that.
Yeah. They have like a lot of cool stuff. Yeah, man, that's, I mean, so what's going on with you? You were talking about you're going out of country.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. I think the competitive nature of the comedy business, as you know, keeps us kind of tethered to certain cities. And, you know, I think I always felt like I've always struggled with the separation of the business and the art.
Yeah.
And I love the art of comedy very much, and like almost too much to not be offended by the industry sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't think anybody that's a manager or an agent is a bad person or anything.
Yeah.
I just think that sometimes they think too little of us as business people.
Yeah.
And kind of just grab the steering wheel away from us sometimes. And, you know, I think like all creative ideas are associative. And if I'm at the point in my comedy where I know I'm funny. I don't think I have to prove that I'm funny, but I need to show how I'm different.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be different, then why would I live the same place that every other person does? You know, at least for me, my creativity tends to come when I'm in a different environment than other people. Everybody has their own process.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always said, you know, I love LA and New York, and if I could have them both, that would be my dream. And I started looking into Barcelona, and Barcelona is this incredibly European city, and it's got such a rich culture, and one of the most punk rock communities. I think the Catalonians are insane. And there's a comedy scene there, enough of a comedy scene for me to keep developing comedy and write sitcoms and, you know, go the way of Hemingway. And see if I can do something special. So I've taken like a teaching certification courses during COVID.
Okay.
And I'm going to get certified to teach English as a foreign language. So I can do that from home as well as write from home and have a little bit of an income. And then that way I can also use a student visa and be able to work in Europe.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm going to do after this. It's my 50th birthday is coming up.
Oh, yay. When's your birthday?
October 20th.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Yeah. Happy advanced birthday, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's another thing the industry tells us to not talk about. But like, you know, fuck that. You know, it's silly. So, yeah, I'm going to be 50, and it's a big deal, I think.
I thought you were 29, Tamar.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot. I have my mom's genes. She doesn't look her age at all.
No, she doesn't. Your mom is fabulous. I have met her. She's amazing.
Oh, thanks, man. She loved you.
She's pretty cool. She's a pretty cool gal. I like her a lot. No, I mean, dude, that sounds amazing that you're going to go off to Spain and do your thing. I have to ask this. Is this for a girl that you're doing this?
No, believe it or not. No, it was really for me. I did meet someone during COVID, and who's a great girl. And we have a ton in common. She's coming with.
Is she from Spain?
No, that's the thing. She's Swedish. Okay. But oddly, like I lived in Sweden for 6 years and she lived in Egypt for two. So we have so much in common, and she also does a job where she can be a digital nomad. That's a new phrase I discovered recently.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just graduated. She's 42, but she just went back to school for something different.
Yeah.
And she, now she's learning how to develop apps and build sites, and she's at the interning stage of her career. So hopefully we think by the time we get to Barcelona, she'll be able to do some work online as well.
Yeah.
If not, it's such a busy city in terms of tourism and other things. And she's super skilled in other ways with other things. So I don't think she's going to have a tough time getting a job.
That's incredible. Good for you guys. That sounds amazing.
Thanks a lot.
You know, it's interesting. You brought that point up. You know, I've been alone here. I don't have any family in LA. All my family's in Dallas. And I just have like my neighbors that I'm really good friends with, and just a handful of friends who I haven't even been able to see because of the pandemic. And I was really questioning the quality of life in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And quality of life in America, period. Actually.
Yes. 100%.
Living in New York versus living in America. I know that everybody has this rah-rah thing that we talk about, that America is the greatest country in the world. Yeah. I feel like when it comes to the quality of life and when it comes to time to spending time with family and friends, I really don't think we have that quality.
I agree.
Don't think we do. I mean, like, what is your experience? I mean, you're an only child. I have four older brothers, and I'm saying that.
Yeah, no, listen, I've lived in 6-7 different countries.
Yeah.
Because before I was a comic, I worked in advertising as a brand strategist on global brands. So I lived in Dubai, Australia, London. You know, and I remember when I was younger and a backpacker, I always thought, oh, it must be weird to be European and go home after you vacation in America going, oh, I'm not going back to the best country in the world.
Yeah.
And then I stopped feeling like I was going back to the best country in the world, Trump, you know.
Yeah.
During the Bush era, I lost faith.
Bush, yeah. Trump, and upset. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I gained a lot of pride when Obama was in office, but it really have, you know, I told this to my mom. I said, I can tolerate racism is something I've learned to tolerate. Prejudice is something I've learned to tolerate. But an unhealthy level of anti-intellectualism,
yeah.
Like thinking that anybody who's has a background in science isn't worth listening to, and that this guy can just stand on stage and say dangerous things, and everybody from a greedy owner of Facebook to different outlets like Fox News, I don't even want to call them news. They're legally classified as an entertainment brand, so they can lie, by the way. So they're not. Yeah, they do that so that you can't sue them for lying. That's how often they lie. Wow. They've legally changed their classification to entertainment instead of news.
Definitely not entertaining, tell you that much.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And again, you know, like I had a friend of mine who's like a lot of us comics are big on free speech, and so am I. I mean, I grew up rooting for the Indians, not the cowboys, and the robbers, not the cops. Like that's the way I always was. But you know what? This guy said, another comic said, dude, I can't believe you're such a hardcore left winger and all this stuff. I go, I'm not.
Right.
And he goes, I told him.
That's not who you come across to me as. I'm not at all.
I'm very much in the middle. I have a Muslim dad and a Jewish mom. So I'm all about the middle. You know what I mean? I've never been able to hate any side.
Exactly.
But, you know, I told him, I can't be friends with you anymore. And he was like, why? And I said, because the stuff you post is really infuriating. He's like, oh, we can't have different opinions. And I'm, of course we can have a different opinion, but not when your opinion is that I deserve less than you.
Right.
Not when your opinion is that it's a racist leader who terrorizes people who look like me and my mother and immigrants and other minorities is a worthy leader. Then no, we can't be friends if that's your opinion.
And not just a different opinion, an uninformed opinion, right?
Yeah.
An opinion.
It's a different,
with no leg to stand on opinion, like a dumb fucking opinion. Like what kind of opinion are you backing exactly?
It's inhumane.
Yeah, it's totally inhumane.
It doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense. And I feel ashamed. I know that that's been an emotion that's been missing online for a lot of people and from a lot of our politicians who all seem to think that they're action heroes, these 80-year-old action heroes. You know, I saw him walking down a ramp. It's so funny. Like Madonna at 40 looks amazing. And when she tried to be sexy, the media was like, ooh, act your age, but we can have Rambo 8. Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
I'm tired of old men acting like macho guys. Like,
but Tamer, you know, that's like sexism. That is just like casual sexism. You know, this is casual. Yeah. Like Jennifer Lopez, who looks like a fucking, she's a rock star at 50.
Yeah.
I'm sure you watched her Super Bowl performance. And they were like, she's a mother. She should act her age. Well, nobody's telling Jack Nicholson to behave like a fucking, you know, a grown ass man. He's like the most eligible bachelor. What the fuck are you talking about, eligible bachelor? Like,
absolutely.
Man is like 60 some odd years old, but Jennifer Lopez is like being told to act her age. I mean, it's just casual sexism that's global, by the way. It's fucking global. It's just repulsive. You were talking about that you've lived in so many different places, like your mom is Jewish and your dad's Muslim. You know, you what age, like I moved from Pakistan at 15 to America. What age?
Oh, wow.
That's
a tougher age. I moved when I was just 8.
Oh, wow.
I think 15 must have been harder,
super
right?
Hard. It was really hard. It was really tough.
So you're already, your clay is starting to harden by 15.
Precisely. Like, but you know what it is? Like, I don't know, and I want to ask you this. Did you go through like identity crisis at some point?
Massive identity crisis. You know,
tell me more.
I mean, a lot of people think that racism towards Middle Eastern people started after 9/11, but there's some people that think that. And I had to explain to some of my friends, I go, I used to watch the news like it was the weather. Because if the news started saying bad things about Arabs, like gas prices are going up because of these damn Arabs, then the kids' parents would say, these goddamn Arabs. And then the kids would come to school and I get jumped. So I would watch the news like it was a weather check for my bullying.
Yeah.
If there was new, if Arabs were in the news, I was going to get bullied. I was going to get picked on.
Right.
And you know, and then I grew up in a very predominantly Mexican neighborhood. I was really lucky when I got older. I started boxing.
LA,
really,
right? In LA?
In LA, yeah. In East LA too. I grew up in a very Mexican neighborhood. Yeah. And, you know, I got into boxing at an early age and, you know, it's a big sport in Mexico. And I love soccer because of being Egyptian. And yeah. So the Mexican kids really embraced me. Yeah. So, you know, I felt like an adopted Mexican, but, you know, according to Judaism, if your mom's a Jew, you're a Jew. But according to Islam, if your dad's a Muslim, you're a Muslim.
So
I was just being pulled in all these different directions.
Right.
And, and then my grandmother's Greek. And the crazy part is that people on the Greek side, I look more
Greek Orthodox.
Yeah. So my grandmother, so literally we had all three major religions in our family.
Wow.
Yeah. Greek Orthodox on my grandmother's, the Christian side of my grandmother, Jewish on my mom, Sephardic Jews, and then Muslim on my dad's side.
Wow. My ex-husband was Greek Orthodox.
Wow.
I got married very young. I moved to America at 15. I met him at 18. I was married at 22. I was divorced at 27. Wow. Yeah, that's been my...
Was he Greek or was he Greek Orthodox?
No, he was Greek. Very Greek. Very Greek.
That's funny.
Yeah, very Greek. Yeah, he was born in Greece, moved to America at 15, the way I did. He was born on in this tiny island called Nisiros, and then moved to Athens, and then moved to America. We met, and we were, and then we were together for a long time, so I know quite a bit about Greek culture.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah,
that's
because
great.
I was married to a Greek man for a very long time. Like, he would take me to these Greek sermons for Easter. You know, Easter is the biggest thing for Greek
world. Yeah.
So,
Christos Anisti.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He would take me to the Greek church. We would go to the Greek church, book of the sermon and everything.
Did you go to St. Sophia? Were you in L.A.?
I was not in L.A., in New York City.
Oh, okay.
I used to That's go to cool. George Stephanopoulos' dad's church.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because his dad's a Greek priest. And I remember I would, like, be sitting, so he'd be, like, lighting the candles and, you know, and
That's
I'd be
great.
Sitting there listening to the sermon in Greek, and I would turn to him, I'm like, it's Greek to me. He was like, haha, very funny. Because it was all in Greek.
You know, my favorite thing I heard an old Greek man saying, he was sitting on a patio and he was playing with those prayer beads,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Only,
and he's like, you know, Tamar, you're from America, yeah? And I go, yeah, I'm from America. He's like, I don't know about America. And I go, why? He's like, you know, we gave them Homer, they gave us Homer Simpson.
Oh, that's cute. That's so funny.
It's like the greatest philosophy, the greatest poetry to the greatest cartoon. Because I like Homer, but it's not the same.
Honestly, like, I thought for the longest time, like, Indian men and Pakistani men were, like, the way they were. And then I married a Greek man, and I was like, okay, yeah, no, you guys are, like, all exactly the same. You guys are, like, you behave the exact same way. You
yeah.
want your woman to stand in the kitchen and cook for you. You want your woman to be, like quiet and subservient to you, like, for God's sake. And I'm not saying everybody's like that, but... My God, like, my ex-husband was very much like that. He was the man, you know, he wanted to be, like, very machismo part of the culture. But listen, I learned a lot of great Greek dishes, so I can't blame him.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
No, you can blame him, though. You know, I think what it is, it's like, even though the hardware doesn't change, the software should. And there's been an update into how you're supposed to treat women and, and minorities and gay people and... Some of us are smartphones and we can download that info, but some of us are flip phones.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I mean, for
and
sure.
We just don't have it. You know what I think it is too? I think cultures that are past their greatness, or they would say, you know, like those guys that are like, oh, my best years were in high school. I think some of the older cultures are like that. We were at our best way back then.
Yeah.
And in cultures like that, there tends to be a culture where young people always do what they're told.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a respect for the way it was more so than the way it is.
Yes.
Versus in America, the one thing I do like about America is that there's like the skin, the snake changes its skin. Like the younger generation always challenges the generation prior.
Yeah.
And in times like this, you can see the necessity and the importance of it. And I hope there's going to be a better America on the other side. But
I agree.
I do challenge the communities, you know, from places like where we come from. Yeah. I challenge those younger people to be a little bit stronger and a little bit bolder and be heard.
You know, that's so interesting you said that. So now with the revolution that we're in right now, which is a beautiful thing, I've been to like multiple marches. I went to the Pride and BLM march yesterday.
It's awesome.
It's been pretty great, right? So, and I look at the reactions of like fellow like South Asians, right? Like Indians and Pakistanis. And some of them are like, I'm proud of you. I'm so glad you're going out and do that. And while other people were like, well, you know, I mean, we're minorities too, and like people are racist against us too. I just don't see it. I got into actually this full-blown argument with this Persian guy. I'm quarter Persian. My grandfather was Iranian, so I was talking about how like I did this racism and misogyny panel with all like these female comics and stuff, and it went really well. And this Iranian guy wrote, "No thanks." He was like, "No thanks, I don't need to attend this." And I was like, "Why did you have the need to comment that?" He was
exactly.
like, I was like, he's like, "I don't play the victim, you know, I don't play the victim. There's no such thing as racism." He's like, "You're anti-American if you talk about racism."
Wow.
Camera, you know, as comics, that's all we need. That's all we need.
He was asking for it.
I screenshot his picture. I screenshot all the roasting that I was doing, and I posted it on my Facebook. And I was like, this guy believes he's fucking white. He thinks any talk of racism is anti-American. And then we all got together and grilled the shit out of him. And then he got on my page and started commenting. And I was like, you can comment whatever the fuck you want. He's like, what else am I supposed to check? I was forced to check white on application at work. And he worked for the Department of Justice, Tamer.
This what is a huge statement.
We're fighting.
Listen to his mentality. My identity is based on what the government tells me it is. There's not a box, I will be what they, and that's what that guy is. He's like, it's like when you go to a hypnosis show, you go, oh, those are the dumbest people. The people that are most deeply hypnotized. Actually, dumbest isn't correct. I'm not trying to start a fight. It's the most suggestible people.
Yeah.
There are people that are open to suggestion more so than other people. And a lot of times those people are really insecure.
Yes.
And a lot of times those people find messages like, you weren't wrong all this time. You weren't a failure for not studying hard. You weren't a failure for not trying until you had a family. You weren't a failure for believing in coal instead of believing in technology. Instead, hey, those brown people fucked it all up.
That's right.
And that message is a powerful message because it goes from, I feel like I am a collection of terrible decisions to, oh my God, I've actually been a hero all this time.
Right.
You know, and it's a lie. It's not the truth. It doesn't help that person anyway. And it's probably the most un-American thing I've ever seen a president do.
Don't you think that in our cultures, you know, you being Egyptian and me being Pakistani, like I feel like we also have privileges, right? We are also in a privileged position to be able to travel.
100%,
I mean, we live in a, you know, well, I mean, that's kind of woke / slightly non-woke society versus what's happening in Egypt or versus what's happening in Pakistan. I mean, I guess societies are much further along here in that sense where we can even have these conversations. In Pakistan, I don't know what it's like in Egypt, but in Pakistan, I can't really have these conversations. People don't want to have these. I mean, it's so like far back where you're just like, how long is it going to take you to catch up? Like, how long is it going to be okay? Like, we were trying to have, the women in Pakistan got together and wanted to have a women's march, okay?
Amazing.
Older women were shaming, along with the men, the younger women, they were shaming them for walking in the streets for equal rights. Like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah,
just for
crazy.
Equal rights? Like, that's where we're at. So I don't know, like, how long do you think it would take, you know, some, like, I think about, like, Pakistan. I don't know what's happening in Egypt. I mean, have they had women's march in Egypt? I mean, Egypt through a massive...
Yeah. Like, they've had a lot of... Sisi is a militant leader now.
Right.
So I think that's been squashed, but he does seem to have a genuine love for the country. And one of the first things he did was organize a marathon. It's like, and had women jogging in it and stuff, which was, I know it sounds like a nothing, but it was actually kind of a big deal in Egypt, you know, which is started to go backwards and more conservative when they had that, you know, Islamic Brotherhood president for a hot couple months.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's changed, but I think you said a key word, which was take. You know, how long will this take? I don't think it's for us to ask permission. I think it's for us to take. It's time. And it's, if you know, it's time for those older people to step away.
Yes.
And it's time for younger people to speak up and to not ask. It's time to take things. And I don't think we should, and in America, I don't think we should wait for white people. It's funny, as I don't think white people are privileged the way I don't think an overwatered cactus is more rich. But like, I think people are better under stress. They become better, stronger. I feel privileged. Mm-hmm. I feel privileged that I've had a harder life than white people. I feel privileged that I was open to traveling and languages and meeting people from other cultures. It opened me up. I feel privileged over white people because being a smart person was something that was deeply respected in my household. Yeah. So I don't feel like they have any advantage over me in the business world. Yeah. In the art world, I've got the advantage. Mm-hmm. I've got the advantage. And I think a lot of us do. A lot of us immigrants and people that have had...
Especially the times we live in today.
100%.
In the 80s and the 90s, we didn't. Even in the early 2000s, we didn't. But now we do. I mean,
it's our time.
I don't know when you... how long have you been doing comedy for now, Tamara?
It was 8 years in March.
8 years in March.
I had my 8 year anniversary,
Oh, wow. Okay. Congrats. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Before I got into comedy, I used to work on the trading floor in New York City. Okay.
Holy shit.
You would never think those things looking at me. Right?
Oh my God. You know what, Mona? I totally could see you. I could totally, you're a tough woman. I love that. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, I was one of the only four women that worked on the trading floor.
That's like, badass. That's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know what it is? Like, I grew up with four older brothers. I always grew up around boys. I was never intimidated. It was never a thing. I don't get intimidated by guys because I grew up with so many men and so much testosterone. So that was never intimidating to me. I started off as an assistant, and then they promoted me to be an analyst, and I used to do really well for myself. And then I left it all for stability and comedy. Because I'm crazy. But after that, I started getting into acting, and I remember this one casting director. This is just telling you about the different times that we live in, that you're talking about the privilege of, hey, you know, it's a great time to be brown in entertainment. But there was a time when I was a stage actor in New York, and this casting director whose class I took, remember that show Ugly Betty? You remember that show?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, it was really popular.
Yeah, the casting director of Ugly Betty, I took his class, and I swear to God, Tamer, I sat in his class and we did the taping and audition, whatever. And then after that, he said to me, he's like, Mona, you're like talented and stuff, but you'll never be the lead. I mean, like, because you're like South Asian and stuff. So like, you'll never, the best you'll ever be is like a third banana, if that. I'll never fucking forget those words as I live, okay? And I look at it today and I was just like, I would love to meet him. I would love to talk to him today. And see, like, what were you saying? I'm sorry, what was that? Because nobody knows.
Stupid thing to say. Nobody knows, exactly. There are no experts.
Ignorant thing to say. Nobody
especially
knows how art will evolve, you know?
He's an expert on the business side. He has no idea how the art works.
Exactly.
He has no idea how the art works. And the business follows the art. It's not the other way around.
That is correct.
Good art doesn't follow business.
That is
good
correct.
Business follows art.
That is exactly that. That is exactly correct.
Yeah, that guy's a moron.
A total moron. And but like that stuff like really stuck with me because for the longest time I was just like, oh, that's all I'm ever gonna be. I'll never have the opportunity to read for, you know, a lead role. And the reason I ended up in LA is because I read for a lead role in a Steven Spielberg project.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, you talk about like, you know, something coming along and just like knocking that stupid kind of belief system out.
Absolutely. Everything like, happens for a reason. I like when stuff like that. That's a cliche statement, right? But I do believe in energy and flow.
The
being able to catch the wind, being able to catch waves. I do think there's other forms of invisible energy that we can catch. And when that guy said that thing, and for that to happen immediately after, fucking it, that's catching a wave.
That's right.
What.
That's like the universe coming, saying, "No, that's not the truth. Let me show you what the real truth is. Let me show
you that guy." Yeah.
Fuck that guy. So now, Tamara, do you like, you know what, it's funny because right before we started taping this, I was thinking, I was like, oh man, I've been watching the show Rami, and every time I watch it, I somehow see you in there. I don't know why. And maybe it's like that Egyptian connection I keep making. But I was like, man, yeah. Tamer would be really good in it. I wonder what.
Oh, that's nice. Tell Rami.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Dude, but you know Rami. You've worked with Rami.
Yeah, no, we're friends. Absolutely. And it's why I would never, you know. I mean, I've always sent him congratulations texts and things like that. But
yeah,
we're not in the same circle. It's really funny. I haven't really been embraced by the Middle Eastern comedy community at all.
Interesting.
But
why do you think that is, Tamer?
I think that they have a certain definition of what it means to be an Arab comedian, and mm-hmm. I don't tick some critical boxes. You know, yeah. I think I'm different than there in a lot of ways. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people in the Middle Eastern comedy community that are probably a little bit more religious than people think they are. And I'm not saying this about anybody in particular, by the way. I'm just saying, I think that there is some people.
Chill out, name names. Yeah. But
I mean, it's not anybody whose name anybody would even know, just from being around certain festivals. And so I was in a festival, not patting my own back, where I literally got a standing ovation. And I was never, and every other comic
like
that was
on
the
Arab comedy festival?
I don't want to say, but every other comic that was on it was invited back, got gigs. I was never invited back and never got another gig.
Shit.
Never.
Can I tell you something, Tamer? I'm not shocked to hear that.
Yeah, and that's okay. I'm not mad at them or anything that. It's that my path is a different path.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Ellen wasn't a gay comedian. She was a comedian that happened to be gay. And I think that's my path. I don't think I'm an Arab comedian. I think I'm a comedian that happens to be Arab.
If
that doesn't fit their definition, that's totally cool. I mean, they're allowed to create whatever they want to create. I just don't seem to be fitting into what they're looking for, though.
You know, that's interesting. You're talking about checking boxes, right? And like, I think that's one of the things that I am always kind of, and maybe fighting or just trying to get away from. Where I was having this conversation with Shazia Mirza. You know who she is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. She's great.
Shazia's great. So Shazia, I had her on as a guest, and we were talking, and I was like, Shazia, like, what is this? Why are female comics always kind of put in these boxes that we have to just kind of check these certain, like, oh, you can only talk about this and that, and that's it. Those are just the things you can talk about, nothing else. And she was like, yeah, she's like, somehow that when you were a brown female comic, you're only supposed to allow to talk about issues. Like, you can't just talk about your person, like your personality. You can't talk about anything outside of that. You were just talking about boxes. So I feel like, I guess you also have like, they are Arab comics or like, I guess Asian comedians also kind of have these kind of boxes that you check, which you kind of have to fulfill, or otherwise you're not part of the clan.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like one of those situations where you go into a clothing store and there's nothing you like. Do you change your style or do you learn how to make outfits? You know, and I think those boxes.
Just go to another store.
Well, I mean, that's what it feels like to be labeled sometimes. You know, it feels like the industry is saying, you got to be this, this, and this. And if you're not those things, then you don't get to wear this outfit. And I'm like, well, I'll just make my own then. Because, I mean, that's the greatest thing about being a comedian. Yeah. You're the writer. You're the producer, you're the talent, you do it all. Yes. So then why not? Then why not do it all? Why not take a legitimate superpower? Because I've seen some insanely talented people with insanely huge fan bases try to do what we do, and boy, have they struggled. So it is not an easy skill to gain. You gotta be really tough in the soul and in the feels to tolerate it and take it for as many years as we have.
Yeah.
And you know, why not use that superpower to then write your own screenplay, write your own sitcom, write your own film? That's you know, just like I said earlier, I'm not asking for permission from the industry anymore. I'm not asking for permission from white people anymore. The only person I'm asking for permission from is me.
Yes.
That's 100%. It. I'm taking my shit. I'm making 100%. My shit now.
100%. 100%. Yeah. I think
I like it better.
Power. I mean, there's so much power in what you just said, right? There's just so much power. And I think you and I come from the exact same place in that sense, that I don't sit around and wait for people to be like, oh, do I check this box? Do I check that box? I'm like, nah, fuck it. I'll just walk my own journey. I would just walk my own path. And I feel like I've done pretty decent for myself, considering considering being told that I'll only play the third banana in a movie someday. anything I've done.
Your bananas are usually the best. The two in the beginning are too green. The two in the back are too brown.
Right.
Third banana sounds like the yellow banana to me.
Right down the middle, right there. It's right
the
down
sweetest the banana.
Right. I know that you are a big Richard Pryor fan.
Yeah. Sorry, I was burning incense and I was worried. I thought it fell and wanted to make sure.
Did it fall?
It's good. No, that's
we don't want to burn the place down, Tamer. We're not doing that right now.
I'm so ethnic, right? I'm burning incense.
Dude, I don't know about you. I think maybe you don't have that, but I have really, like, I can't smell incense. I, like, legit get PTSD when I smell incense.
Wow.
I have, like, so much, like, trauma attached to the smell of incense.
Wow.
That when I smell it, I literally have to just walk away before I start tearing up. I mean, just because I think you were there when I talk about my story about my father and about, you know, the kind of, but the reason this whole incense thing, I just like it, like incense irks me to no end. On Thursdays are, you know, right before Fridays, which is a holy day for Muslims. And my mom would light these incenses. And every time she would light these incenses, somehow it just would be happening that my parents would be in a fucking some kind of a fight or bickering, you know, and where my dad is like slapping my mom around or he's slapping one of us around. So every time I smell incense, I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna get like slapped in the face or something.
Yeah, it's a powerful thing.
It's so powerful. Yeah. Like anchored. It's anchored in my brain.
Yeah, we do that, you know, like we're bottom of the food chain animals really until we invented fire. But I was in Afghanistan performing for the troops, and one time we were going to fly in a helicopter in a sandstorm, and you know, I told our point of contact guy, I said, "Oh, I'm going to listen to this AC/DC album. It'll pump up my courage." And he goes, "Do you like that album?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Don't put it on." And I'm like, "Why?" And he goes, "Because if something bad happens, you'll never listen to that album again."
Shit, he's right.
And I was like, "Whoa!" And he goes, "Yeah, you don't." You know, we're going to be fine. I'm sure we'll be fine, but I wouldn't listen to your favorite one. And I was like, fuck.
That's powerful.
It's pretty scary. Yeah, but it's true. I mean, I that's what we do as human beings.
Right.
It's almost, you know, it goes, that is danger. And that was there when danger happened. So let's avoid that too.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, speaking of pain and speaking of danger, like I know that you're a big Richard Pryor fan, and I was watching on Hulu The Last Days of Pryor. I'm sure you've watched it already. And I was watching it, and he said something that really just cleared things for me. And tell me if you picked up on it or it did the same thing for you. He talked about how, you know, he was trying to be like Bill Cosby, and, you know, Bill Cosby was the big guy, and then, you know, and, you know, Pryor's in the middle of like finding his own voice. And he's like, you know, which way do I go? Like, who am I? Like, you know, I have all this trauma and all these demons that I want to talk about. But then I'm also expected to be like, you know, like a good clean cut kind of guy. Like, kind of like, why don't you be like Bill Cosby, right? Who's a rapist. And then he said something that fucking just like clicked in me. And he said, Bill Cosby wants to be liked by everybody. He's like, I want to be unliked. He's like, I want to be unlikable. Everybody wants to be likable. I want to be unlikable, because unlikable means I get to speak my truth. And if you like what you see, then you'll stay. And if you don't, you can fucking leave. End of fucking story.
The irony is that's what made him so lovable.
That's exactly
what because he was being honest. It's honest. Honesty doesn't make people not like you. My therapist came to a show one time. And he said that was he looked at me after, because I was moving to New York, and he finally came to a show, because he wasn't able to come to the show before until we kind of ended our working relationship.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I didn't expect this experience. I didn't expect it to be so cathartic watching you. And I said, how do you mean? He goes, listen, it's like we're an audience of domesticated dogs in warm homes with food and water and shelter, but we have to follow these rules. We have to wear a leash. And then he flipped up his tie. He goes, but you don't. You don't have an HR department as a comedian. And I felt like a dog watching a wolf.
Wow.
I could look at you and say, I am of you. And that's what it's like to be free. Even though I can't be that free anymore, boy, do I enjoy watching it.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. So it's free. It's freedom.
Right.
Freedom is like a massively attracted thing for all of us, because we're we're trapped here and we don't know why we're here and we don't know what's going to happen after, if anything happens after. And I think freedom is everything. I mean, it shows that we're healthy, that we're strong, that we're in control, that we're living. The only thing we know is that being happy feels good. And, you know, then maybe that should be something we should do.
Yes,
you know?
For sure. Freedom is my drug. Like,
me too.
Yeah, freedom is my drug. Like, if today where you were like, you know, Mona, I'll give you all the money, you get to do whatever you want, you know, but I get to control you and I get to take your freedom. I'm like, give me a gun so I could put it in my mouth. Like, let me just end it because it's not worth it for me. I would rather eat spam and then, you know, and live life on my own terms than eat a steak and live in a golden palace. When I was married to my ex-husband, you know, that was my fucking golden palace that I lived in, you know, and it sucked. I mean, you and I think have similar backgrounds in the sense that, well, besides being brown, but about the trauma aspect of it.
Yeah.
I mean, your dad was pretty abusive towards you physically, and I guess I would say verbally and emotionally. I mean, when you moved out here into LA at the age of 8, did he move out here with you?
No, he moved first. And I think that's where the problem started, quite honestly. I think racism made my dad abusive. I know that sounds crazy, but I think it's true. I think immigrants...
Because he wasn't like that in Egypt. He wasn't like
that. No. Interesting. In Egypt, the memory I have of him in Egypt was being a little boy on his shoulders and him calling me his prince. And then, you know, we were separated for a year and a half to 2 years at a pretty young age. And where my mom would trace my hand in letters so we could see how much I was growing. We didn't have FaceTime or anything like that.
Right.
And I remember getting to the airport and as a kid, now he had a mustache and a bald spot. He had really aged in those two very stressful years. And I just went, that's not my dad. And then he wasn't. His temperament had changed. He was much more depressed, much more negative. There were people that flat out told him right to his face, we're not going to hire you because you're Muslim. And then the one guy finally told him, we're not going to hire you because you're Muslim. And my dad stood up and stuck out his hand to shake his hand. And the guy just like looked up at my dad. He goes, why are you trying to shake my hand? He said, because you're not the first person to say that to me. And I figure if you're going to say things like that, then I'm going to stay a man and I'm going to stay a professional.
Right.
And the guy just like looks at my dad and he goes, can you start on Monday? And my dad goes, yeah. And he got the job.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's
like the thing I'm most, he was an accountant.
Oh, wow.
But he wanted to be, he was originally in a Beatles cover band.
No shit.
I think I was his dream killer. I think having a kid stopped him from pursuing music.
Yeah.
And coming to America, I mean, after you marry someone of an opposite religion in Egypt and a Jew, no less, it's not safe to stay in Egypt. So I think his life might have been a lot different had he not had me. And I think that was all a lot of like resentment
that you were born.
Yeah, probably. He probably had some resentment towards my birth and then resentment towards America, because America wasn't what it promised to be. And the racism was at a pretty intense level, even back then. And I think he brought those frustrations home and didn't believe in therapy or have any other outlet. Mm-hmm. And then I think when you have this, you know, hyperactive kid that probably had a little bit of ADHD and stuff, you know, he probably just wanted to relax and I just drove him crazy. So I think that's a lot of the anger I think comes from people probably being racist to him was probably what turned him into an abusive man.
Was he abusive not just towards you? Was he abusive towards your mom also? Or,
you know, that's the craziest part. And the part that makes me respect him a little bit more than I probably would have is that he was always very decent to my mom. There's only like one time I think where it got
tense
where it was like there was a time where we thought maybe he was having an affair or something, and I was already in high school and I was a bodybuilder. I was huge, like I was almost like 180 pounds, like no body fat, and I got in his face, and it's really weird to almost get in a fight with your dad, physical fight with your dad. That's a very unusual feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, like my story where I was in a verbal war with my dad, like, which is, you know, I think I think it's it lands a lot differently for men of our background when it's a guy versus when it's a girl. Like when a guy stands up, it's like, okay, he's still a son. But when a girl stands up, you're just like, okay, where the fuck did I go wrong?
Yeah,
like,
it's really unfair. A lot of societies are really unfair to women. It's really crazy. Yeah. As including America.
Yes.
I've seen it where I've seen female comics say some amazing jokes and I laugh out loud and I hear my own laugh and kind of a shitty audience judging her. And it's not just men, it's other women.
Yes,
sometimes where I go, dude, if a guy said that joke, you'd be laughing your asses off. Fuck you.
Yes,
that's not cool.
Well, the misogyny is pretty internalized, right? And that's it's very internalized. It's not just with guys; it's also with women. Women also have internalized that misogyny, and we do it to women consciously or subconsciously.
Sure.
I mean, we do it all the time. I mean, I experienced that with a fellow Pakistani women. I got invited last year to come and perform in front of for Eid. They asked me to come out and perform in front of like this crowd of 2,000 Pakistanis in New York.
Wow.
And I got flown out and I was performing on the stage and holy shit, right before me was this big Pakistani band that was performing and I become friends with them and they were like cheering them on. They were like all about it. And the moment I got on, Tamer, no, they did not. Wow. The guys wanted to see me. The women didn't want to see me up there. Can you believe this shit?
It's a strange thing.
So bizarre. The guys were like, oh my gosh, to find this and that. I got off stage. I got into the crowd. I was doing crowd work. I was like talking to everybody. I was having a good time. And the women were telling me to get off the stage. The women were telling me to stop doing comedy. And I was like, fuck you. I was like, not only am I going to continue doing comedy, now I'm going to fucking roast you. So go fuck you. You know?
The Bill Burr of Pakistan. 9 more minutes.
Exactly. I'm like, fuck you. What was that now?
Crazy.
I was like, what's the matter? Your husband doesn't fuck you anymore. You got to take your anger out on me. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, there's a really famous Oscar Wilde quote that I like where he says, I think it's Oscar Wilde. He said, if you want to make an enemy, change something.
Mm.
It's anything. And I think female comics bother maybe traditionalists, male or female, more than male comics do because you're a bigger change to the norm. And whether that change means, oh, well, what does that mean about me as a man? Or whether that change means, oh, what does that mean about me as a woman?
Yes.
Then I think they take it out on you.
Yes. Tamer, how much would you say that pain has been a driving factor for you to become a stand-up comic and it continues to play a role in your comedy?
Funny. You know, I think we have this reputation as being dark, you know, comedians or enjoying the darkness. I like the light. And so it's like saying, oh, wow, firemen must love fire. It's like, nah, we're the ones that talk about the dark things.
Yeah.
It's regular people that are dark.
Yeah.
It's comics that are light. I'm not afraid to talk about abuse. Neither are you.
Yeah.
But no, but the average person is. So who's the dark one? It's not us.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of laughter for me is to lighten the mood. I don't want this thing weighing me down. I want to cut off these chains. I want to lighten this weight.
Yeah.
I want to be like prisoners in a cell that found a way to use humor is an emotional fuck you to people that are trying to hold you down.
Yeah.
And so, so in a way, does darkness motivate my comedy or inspire some of it?
Not even so much darkness. I was just saying how much just trauma and pain plays a role.
I think it's, if I could adjust it slightly, I would say my biggest motivation probably, and I didn't really think about it until you said that, is my desire for lightness. Right. Even when I was a kid, I used to live in this Mexican neighborhood where it was not okay to smile outside. Like it was, if you smiled outside or were too much of a joker, then kids who wanted to prove their manhood would be like, all right, I'm going to jump that guy. And when I first lived in East LA, I used to smile a lot and I had kind of a noticeable smile.
Yeah.
And I used to get jumped all the time and I stopped smiling outside. I only smiled inside my house.
Wow.
And in Mexican culture, they give you a nickname that's the opposite of what you are. So they call tall guy shorty. They call fat guy skinny. They used to call me Joker because I never smiled.
Wow.
Never. Wow. And I think I, for a long time, I held my breath, emotionally held my breath. And I think now I'm free. You know, I feel free. And because I feel free, I want to add lightness to some of those dark memories, and I want to take away some of that pain. And for some odd reason, I don't know why, physiologically, when other people laugh with me about things that have hurt me, it's the best painkiller in the world.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree. You know, we are currently living in a time where there is this this shift happening in stand-up comedy, which is, we are talking about like the introduction of the PC culture and how it's affecting comedy. And I like to have these conversations with different comics about how the PC culture is affecting them and how it affects their art and their comedy. Do you think, in your opinion, what do you think PC culture is doing for comedy?
It's funny. I know what the stereotypical answer is, that it's making it harder to be funny. And I call bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, they're ruining comedy, they're killing comedy. It's like, oh, really? Are they? Are you Lenny Bruce getting arrested for saying bad words? Are you George Carlin? Are you Richard Pryor?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
None of those people stop. Like, I mean.
But people are getting their shows canceled. Just playing the devil's advocate. Like, people are getting their shows canceled. Like, people are getting canceled.
Good. Fine. Yeah. Then James Brown straightened his hair and dressed gay in order to stop white men from being worried he was going to rape white women. And then he created his own style out of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
If there are barriers, then you push through those barriers. I'm sorry that a lot of comics don't seem to be familiar with barriers, but I think a lot of us are.
Yes.
And like, if society...
That's all I know is barriers. Jesus.
That's all I know too. And if society is deciding that it's going to make a change, then it's your job. It's your job as a comic to make a change. If you don't want to make a change, you don't have to. No one's forcing you to. They're not really saying they're taking away my freedom of speech. They're saying, how come they don't still like me when I say what I want to say?
Yeah.
Like, welcome to being a real comic.
Yes.
Welcome to being a real comic.
Yes.
That's what it fucking means. If 90% of the audience looks like you and you've enjoyed that privilege,
yes,
then guess what? This is what real comedy is like.
Yes.
This is what real comedy is about.
Yes.
And you can, we're going through an evolution. We're going through a massive change.
Yeah.
And how quickly you change, when you change, if you change, is up to you. And whether or not people like you is up to them. You can't bitch about them having an impact on how you behave and simultaneously bitch on how they behave. What? You know what I'm saying? Like, they're saying they need to like whatever I say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're saying I had the right to say this before, and now I can't say it. I feel like
no one's taking it away.
Yeah, I feel like people like Bill Burr or like Joe Rogan, they have these massive followings, right? I mean, Jesus Christ, Joe Rogan just landed $100 million exclusive podcast deal with Spotify. He's doing just fine. What was that?
Yeah, I think that's the death of his podcast, by the way.
The death of his podcast?
It's just the hypocrisy. I think he's hurting his brand. He was always against that before, and Joe's always been a truth teller. And I just think it's a mistake for money that, what's he going to do with it? He's got plenty. I don't know why he would make a financial decision over an ethical or one that...
We can all use a little $100 million?
I guess, yeah. I think, you know, the rich get hungrier for more money.
Yeah.
It's just some people are financially obese, and I don't think he needed that. I would have rathered him maintained his integrity the way Chappelle did when he said no to the network when they wanted to change the Chappelle show.
Yeah.
And I don't think is it Spotify?
Spotify, yeah.
I don't think Spotify is going to damage Joe's brand in any way, but I think he owes it to his listeners to have some kind of explanation as to.
I think Spotify is really ahead of the curve in a lot of the companies, in the sense that, I don't know if you know, but Spotify spent $600 million trying to acquire all these new podcasts like Joe Rogan and all the other ones. So I think Spotify is like really ahead of the curve, and they know like that's the new frontier. Like podcasts.
And they're Swedish. They're a Swedish company too. And I lived in Sweden for 6 years, and I like the way companies behave. They're better. I mean, corporations are still greedy, and putting power on people is like pouring water on gremlins. You know what I mean? Like they just turn into the monsters. But I think of all the corporate entities out there, I think Sweden's pretty good. I think they're pretty decent and pretty fair. They come from a social democracy. So yeah. I think there's a little bit more fairness in a Spotify than there would have been at an Apple Music.
Yeah.
I just think he owes it to his audience to explain it, because it is still a big corporation.
Yeah, I don't think that power corrupts people. I think power just brings out the true essence of who you are. You know, it's just like, if you were given all this money and all this freedom, what kind of a person would you be? And then some people are fucking garbage. And then some people hold on to their integrity and continue to be the awesome human beings that they are.
Sure.
You know,
I think at least it intoxicates people like a booze. You know, I think it changes you. You're right. It's just like drunks. If you're a bad person, being a drunk will show your, it'll amplify your bad traits.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that power will amplify your bad traits the same way booze will.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a saying we have in Urdu, which is, if you are beautiful, the delicacy comes with it. Like you start acting a little delicate because you're beautiful. It just comes with it. It's just like part of the game. I don't know, man. I don't know. Tell me about your podcast, which is They Try to Bury Us. I was reading the origin of it, which it has, you were inspired by the Mexican quote by a abuela, apparently, who said, they tried to bury us, they didn't know we were seeds.
I mean, it's a pretty old quote. I found out it's actually even as far back as Greek poetry, but Cesar Chavez used it in some of the civil rights marches that the Mexican farmers and stuff with the si se puede and yes we, which is something that Obama turned into English, by the way. So it was and the first time I heard that phrase was when I came home with a black eye, and my Mexican neighbor told me that quote. He goes, "You're one of us because you struggle." He's like, "You got pyramids, we got pyramids." He's like, "You're one of us." And it was really sweet. I think I needed that, you know? I needed someone.
But the Egyptians don't eat spicy food.
No, you're right. We don't really eat that much spicy food, but I mean, I do.
I think the Mexican culture is pretty similar to Indian Pakistani culture. Big family.
Yeah. I agree.
Children.
That's true.
Yeah, we're big on not pulling out. We're really big on it.
It's probably out of all my relatives, if you took a poll of other cultures besides Middle Eastern that they married into, Mexican would lead by far.
Oh, wow.
Like I think like almost half, more than half of my relatives who've married outside of our birthplace married Mexican people.
Which makes sense because LA has a massive Mexican population.
Sure, it does. But it also, it has a lot of other nationalities too. And they seem to have, but I think it's important to have certain things in common.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, now more than ever, you notice that, you know, when people start talking, "Oh, I'm your friend just because my opinion's different." I'm going, yeah, but there's morality too. Morality. Mm-hmm. We can't have a different set of morals where you treat me worse than I treat you. Right. You know, and I think there's certain big things in common, like morality and respect for family and being there for each other. And I think those are important things to have in common. I think that the Mexican culture is, I have so much respect for them. The way they treated me as an immigrant, I was like an immigrant within an immigrant population, and boy did they treat me better than Americans did. They treated me really well, and they knew, it's almost like they could feel what I felt.
Yeah.
And they went out of their way to say things like, "You're one of us," and "You're Mexican too," and all that stuff. It was really,
you feel belong, really cool. Like you belong.
That is the, you know what I found out later in life is that Maslow was wrong. The strongest human drive is a drive to belong.
Yeah.
Before food and shelter. Yeah. Even before food and shelter.
Yes.
And I think that they recognize that because they probably felt it.
You know? Yes. You know, I'm going to loop it back to the point we were talking about. You were talking about when you got the standing ovation at a festival and you were not invited back to this place.
Yeah.
I personally think, and this is the same thing with us too, with South Asians also, there is this thing about identity that people don't want to get away from identity, even if they don't understand it, right?
Yeah.
So there's a comic, I'm not gonna mention this person, this person got invited on a podcast, and they're Muslim, and they don't know much about Islam. They really don't. They haven't taken the time to study it, but they just know that they're Muslim because they want to hold on to the identity of being Muslim. Okay.
Yeah.
They know the history of Islam. They don't know what it's like. You know, they don't know about the history of Prophet Muhammad and how Islam came into existence and all the rights it brought along, and you know, how the people of Quraysh were fighting with each other. You know, I know that because A, I want to read, and B, also I'm a big history buff. So I love reading history. This person went on a podcast and ate a giant dick, okay? Because they didn't know their ass was a hole in the ground, okay? And then this person calls me after the podcast taping. They're like, you know, they were asking me all this stuff about the religion and I didn't really know. And I was just like kind of stumbling, fumbling. And do you think I should go back and tell them to delete the episode and just don't talk about it? And I was like, first of all, I don't think they're going to do that. And I was like, second, and I was like, in all honesty, if you are so hung up and so ingrained and holding on to this identity, don't you want to learn about your identity? Don't you want to go and dig up like the faith that you believe in? Don't you want to know more about it, or what the origin is, what it's about, you know, why things are the way they are? And I feel like there is this kind of, I'm going to say, shallow identity pride that's happening. That there's just like, I'm really proud to be this, you know, I'm really proud. And you're like, okay, tell me a little bit more about your background. Tell me a little bit more about your faith, you know? And they're like, oh, well, you know, I mean, it's like something along the line and this and that. Have you seen this, or have you experienced this? What people are like, just because now it's cool to be brown. It is cool. It's
cool. Oh, that's funny.
It's cool to be brown, man.
Is it? I didn't know. I didn't know it's cool to be brown. I know it's less cool to be white, so it might be by default. But
yes.
You know, it's funny. I'm of two different opinions when it comes to that. One, I guess when you claim to be Muslim and you talk about being Muslim, it's pretty silly if you don't know what you're talking about.
Basic tenets.
But then I look at Judaism and the flexibility where people are like, I'm culturally Jewish, but I'm not religious. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a reality. I think Islam has such a powerful presence in our lives that the idea of someone who identifies as Muslim but doesn't know much about it is super foreign. Yeah. You know? I'm not one of those people. Like, I wouldn't call myself a Muslim if I didn't know some basic stuff about it.
That's right.
It doesn't really bother me, you know, but here's what it does bother me when someone's not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
It does bother me.
That's the part that bothered me too.
Absolutely.
The person is like, oh, I'm such a rah-rah Muslim. And I'm like, totally. You don't fucking know the basic shit. Like, shut up.
And I do, what I dislike even more than not knowing a certain amount of information is the hermit crabbing, you know, where these guys jump from this shell to that shell, to this shell, to that shell. Now I'm a little bit more this, now I'm a little bit more that. Uh-huh. It doesn't hurt me personally. It just makes me feel bad for them, because especially as a creator, as a writer, he or she is so far away from their identity. If it was that game, you know, getting warmer, to finding your voice, is after you got off that podcast, I'd be like ice cold, bro, ice cold.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether you are a Muslim or aren't a Muslim, the one thing I know is you don't know who you are.
Right.
And that's the message he really sent out.
Yeah.
He didn't, like, to me, I wouldn't have thought to myself, oh, that's a bad Muslim. I just thought to myself, this guy's pretending to be something he's not. And
that's exactly what I thought. I didn't think about the bad Muslim. I just thought about, I was just like, you are so on such this rah-rah thing, and then you can't pick it up. Like, that, to me, that inauthentic part is what really kind of bothers me. Sometimes.
Yeah. Like, I saw once or twice I might have had like a ping of jealousy where I was like, I can't believe this motherfucker is calling himself Muslim all of a sudden. You know, I've seen guys who like aren't really Arab at all, and all of a sudden they're really leaning into it. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? And then I saw them perform and I was like, I don't feel bad anymore, because you just can't fake it in comedy. You just can't do it. The collective intelligence of the room they can see through people.
That's
right. So my jealousy immediately went away.
Yeah. Honestly, it's not even about jealousy, because I'm just like, yeah. Okay, now there's nothing.
Or frustration. Yeah.
I think for me, it was just the dishonesty part.
Sure. And I get that. I totally get it. Yeah.
I think it was just the dishonesty part where you walk around being all like religious and shit and then.
Totally. Hey, yeah. And listen, I mean, just like anything, Islam does not come easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an easy upbringing. It's not a lot of us have good stories. Yeah. A lot of us have bad stories, you know, yeah. Like Catholicism, you know, there's a lot of what retired Catholics, as they say, right. But I think it's especially hard when you feel like you've earned your stripes, for yeah. lack of a better phrase, yeah. or earned the right and the credibility yeah. to refer to yourself as Muslim, and then see someone go up there and just use it in such a hollow way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's upsetting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was the part that kind of upset me. But, you know, I guess I hope this person took the time to educate themselves and learn about it. I think for me...
It's not that hard to learn the basics.
Just Google it. I mean, it's yeah. just, you know, it's five pillars.
It's not like American podcast hosts are asking any real deep questions about the Quran.
Right? We're just like, is that in the... You know, I think a lot of people... I don't know how much you've kind of dug into this. I think a lot of people... don't understand. Some people think that the hadiths come from the Quran. They don't. Yeah. The hadiths came hundreds of years after Prophet Muhammad passed away. Hadiths yeah. came into existence because it was part of the Islamic law, because people wanted to know how Prophet Muhammad would have wanted us to live. And that's how hadiths came into existence, because of all the caliphates, you know, who ended up coming up with the hadiths. But a lot of Muslims don't even know that. They're like, oh, whatever the hadiths say. And so it's like, have you yeah. read some of the hadiths? Yo, they are gross. Like, some of the shit yeah. they talk about in hadith, you're just like, there's no way this is in the Quran. There's just no yeah. way. It's just too yeah. sexual. It's well, hey, man,
yeah, you can tell. You just see, you can feel the fingerprint of man on the Bible, on the Quran, on the Torah. You there are parts of it where you just go, wow, that's an absolute truth. And it's, if my heart could nod its head yes, there yeah. were moments in the Quran where my heart was nodding its head yes. The yeah. way that we're all equal, like the teeth of a comb. And yeah. that's why we pray that. Wow. Like yeah. that made me go, oh, I had so much pride. Mm-hmm. And then you'd read these other things. And I was going, that's not the same author.
Yeah.
Not the same fingerprint. That's somebody yeah. else trying to manipulate
yeah.
and take power when they saw the huge following and the huge fan base.
Yes.
I think those books are just like child celebrities. You know, they get really big, they get a huge following, and in comes this manager going, stick with me, kid, we'll get even bigger. You yeah, know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what they did to a lot of those books, is they've yes. been corrupted.
Yes. I mean, I like some of the stuff is just like outrageous. There was this mullah, this Pakistani mullah, he was talking about, he was like, oh, if you're a good Muslim man, when you die, oh, you don't even understand. He's like, there's going to be one more beautiful woman than the next. And he goes, and when you're done banging this one, oh, there's going to be another one who's going to come and tap your shoulder. And she's going to be like, what about me? What about my desires? I'm like, this is written by a horny man. This is written by a dude who doesn't get ass on the regular. This is written by.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no way the Quran says that. Like this, and it's a hadith. It's a hadith.
And it sounds like it was written by a virgin. You know, like nobody who's ever has any understanding of what an actual sexual and loving connection is with another person, it would say, oh yeah, give me another 72 of those.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Nobody's saying this.
Yeah.
One is hard enough. Just try to get it in with one. Why are you trying to work the other 71? For God's sake.
Doesn't make sense.
Ridiculous, man. Fucking ridiculous. So what's on the horizon for you? Now you're in New York. What's going on? Are you going to stay in New York? Are you going to be traveling? I know you said you're going to move to Spain.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go out to, hopefully, I'll get some job offers teaching English in Spain.
Yeah.
And
when are you leaving? Tamer, when are you leaving?
I'm going to go for my birthday. I'm going to go for a month.
In October.
In October. And then, well, I'm actually going to go like mid-September, because that's when the interview season is. Uh-huh. And I'm going to interview and hopefully get a job. And then I'm going to spend my actual birthday in San Sebastian, which is Basque country. And one of the most beautiful places in the world and the most amazing food in the world. I'm a huge Bourdain fan. Wow. And, you know, I follow his, not just the episodes, but a lot of his articles and books and stuff. And he's turned me on to corners of the world that I didn't think I could get to.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go there And I'm really gonna push my writing, and there's a good little scene in Barcelona, and the rest of Europe is very close and very affordable, and like you know, I've got a fairly decent fan base in Western Europe, so
yeah.
I'm gonna do that. And if at the end of the year I want to come back, I'll come back, but be able to speak Spanish fluently.
That's so amazing, man.
Yeah, I think it's.
I'm very excited for you.
Thank you. Cool. Thanks a lot. Hope that's the goal, but who knows what'll happen.
I'm very very excited for you.
Thanks a lot.
Do you have like shows and stuff lined up? I thought I saw on your website you have shows in Ireland.
I do. Well, I had a show in Ireland. It's getting rescheduled, hopefully for September. I have a show coming up in Sacramento at Laughs Unlimited for 4th of July weekend.
Okay.
There's going to be social distancing rules and all that stuff. The specifics of it I'll post about, but I just posted that on my Instagram the other day. That it's going to be my first live comedy experience. But
amazing.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It'll be cool to see how it feels.
It sounds amazing, man. Well, this has been friggin' awesome. What a great conversation.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation. So
we're definitely
going to
do another one of these for sure. And if you want, if your mom is looking for a new daughter to adopt, I'm available.
yeah. No, hopefully if I love it a lot, I'll take her with me to Spain.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she would love that.
She deserves to be living out. She lives in a great little place now. She's quite happy and quite independent, but
good for her.
Maybe in the future I'll bring her out with me.
That's amazing.
Who knows what'll happen? Who knows? But I'm up for the wind blowing me.
Whatever it is, man, I just stay safe. You got the antibodies already. So.
Yeah, I do. I'm Superman.
I think you should be selling your blood on the sidewalk. Got some antibodies. I got them right here. Got some antibodies. You want to inject them?
Man, in this part of New York, people are selling some weird shit. It wouldn't be that weird if I was selling.
Shooting them in their necks and shit. So like, let me shoot in your neck for you. What is this, heroin? Antibodies, man. It's antibodies. The new heroin. What? It's the new heroin.
That's funny.
That would be amazing. Tamara, where can we find you?
The best place is I'm pretty active on my Instagram. It's at Tamer Kat, TAMERKAT.
Yeah.
And I'll keep everybody posted on everything there. And then we're on a little hiatus from the podcast for now.
Okay.
And then we're going to figure that out in the next few months. And then hopefully on to Spain and then have some stuff to sell in LA soon.
Sounds amazing. And what's your website where we can...
It's tamerkatan.com. So TAMERKATTAN.com. And I put up all my info on there pretty regularly too.
Tamer, eat a ton of food in Spain for me, please. I am dying to go to Spain.
Oh, I will. I'm totally going to become a fatso.
I would love that, please. I think that's one place to become a fatso, and it's totally Spain, but thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Hope to see you soon.
Hope to see you soon too. Take care.
All right. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
That was the amazing Tamer Kattan. You guys, have you subscribed to the YouTube channel? If you haven't, this is the time. We are putting out exclusive content every single day, every single week. We have new podcasts with amazing change makers, amazing comedians, amazing artists. We're doing it right here. Mona Shake YouTube channel. Subscribe. You can follow us on Instagram at Mona's Comedy, Twitter at Mona's Comedy. I'll see you next time.